I'd think about her heart jumping and flapping around in her small chest like a fish in a footlocker after those long runs at the top of the summit. I'd wonder how anything could ever be so alive.
This week on Selected Shorts, Running for Love and A Diva Yearns.
Selma Schumann was a singer without a romance. No one felt the incongruity of this more than she did, yet she had lived to the age of 42 without ever having known an affaire de coeur.
I'm Cynthia Nixon, and you're listening to Selected Shorts from PRI, the program that brings you great short fiction read live on stage at Symphony Space in New York City. I can't remember the first time Isaiah asked me to read something, but it just sort of seems like I've been, doing it forever. It's certainly fun to be backstage in an environment where people care so much about literature. And it's fun to be, of course, on stage because the audience is so rapt. When you're reading a short story or a piece of writing, first of all, of course, you get a chance to embody a lot of different characters, which is fun, and also an omniscient narrator, oftentimes, so you get to play God, which is terrific. But you really get to sort of forget about yourself. It's fun to just have your voice be the whole thing. I'm thrilled to be a radio host. I feel like I've spent a fair amount of time doing television, but I feel that radio is actually my natural medium. On this program, two very different love stories by the American writers Rick Bass and Willa Cather, and one story about being ready for love and life by the Israeli writer Etgar Carrot. Our first story, Fires, by Rick Bass, is set in a remote part of northern Montana, where a world-class runner has come to train. I'm here in the studio with Shorts literary commentator and editor of One Story magazine, Hannah Tinti. Hello, Hannah.
Hi, Cynthia.
So, tell me, I understand that Rick Bass is not only a fiction writer, but also a committed environmentalist.
Yes, a great deal of Rick Bass's writing concerns the environment. And in Fires, the setting of the northern woods ends up being a character itself, playing an important role in this delicate love story. Rick Bass actually got started writing when he was a petroleum geologist, and now he works to protect wilderness areas from development and logging interests.
Fires is from Rick Bass's 1997 collection, In the Loyal Mountains. It's performed by the terrific actor, Ted Marcoux.
Some years, the heat comes in April. There's always wind in April, but with luck, there is warmth, too. There's usually a drought so that the fields work dry and the wind is from the south. Everyone in the valley moves their seedlings from the indoors to the outdoors into their old barns turned into greenhouses. Root crops are what do best up here. Soil is rich from all the many fires, and potatoes from this valley taste like candy. Carrots pull free of the dark earth and taste like crisp sun. I like to cook with onions. Strawberries do well, too, if they're kept watered. The snow line has moved up out of the valley by April, up into the woods, and even on up above the woods, disappearing, except for the smallest remote oval patches of it. And the snowshoe hares, gaunt but still white, move down out of the snow as it retreats to get to the garden's fresh berries and the green growing grasses. But you can see the hares coming a mile away, coming after your berries. Hopping through the green and gold sun-filled woods as white and pure as Persian cats, hopping over brown logs, coming down the centuries-old game trails of black earth. The rabbits come straight from my outside garden like zombies, relentless. And I sit on the back porch and sight in on them. But because they are too beautiful to kill in great numbers, I shoot only one every month or so just to warn them. I clean the one I shoot and fry it in a skillet with onions and half a piece of bacon. Sometimes at night, I'll go up and look out the window and see the rabbits out in the garden nibbling at whatever's available, but also standing around the greenhouse, all around it, just aching to get in. Several of them digging at the earth around it, trying to tunnel in, dirt flying all through the air, while others of them just sit there at the doorway, waiting. The hares are only snow white like that for a few weeks after the snow is gone. Then they begin to lose the white fur, or rather, they do not lose it, but it begins to turn brown like leaves decaying. So that they are molted for a while during the change, but then finally they are completely brown and safe again with the snows gone. But for those few weeks when they are still white, the rabbits sit out in my garden like white boulders. I haven't had a woman living with me in a long time now. Whenever one does move in with me, it feels as if I've tricked her, have caught her in a trap, as if the gate has been closed behind her and she doesn't yet realize it. It's very remote up here. One summer, my friend Tom's sister came here to spend the summer with Tom and his wife Nancy and to train at altitude. Her name was Glenda, and she was a runner from Washington, and that was all she did, was run. Glenda was very good, and she had run in races in Italy, in France, and in Switzerland. She told everyone when she got up here that this was the most beautiful place that she'd ever seen. Told all these rough loggers and their hard wives this, and we all believed her. Very few of us had been anywhere else to be able to question her. We would all sit out at the picnic tables in front of the saloon, 10 or 12 of us at a time, half the town, and watch the river. Ducks and geese heading back north stopped on our valley to breed, to build nests and to raise their young. Ravens with their wings and backs shining greasy in the sun were always flying across the valley from one side of the mountains to the other. Anyone who needed to make a little money could always do so in April by planting seedlings for the Forest Service. And it was always a time of relaxation because of that fact. A time of no tempers, only loose happiness. I did not need much money in April or in any other month, and I would often sit out at the picnic table with Glenda and Tom and Nancy and drink beer. Glenda would never drink more than two. She had yellow hair that was cut short and lake blue eyes, a pale face, and a big grin, not unlike Tom's, that belied her seriousness, though. Now that she is gone, I think I remember her always being able to grin because of her seriousness. I certainly don't understand why it seems that way to me now. Like the rest of us, Glenda had no worries, not in April, and certainly not later on in the summer. She had only to run. I never saw Glenda in the fall, which was when she left. I don't know if she ever smiled like that when she got back to Washington or not. She was separated from her boyfriend who lived in California. She didn't seem to miss him, didn't ever seem to think about him. The planters burned the slopes they had cut the previous summer and fall before planting the seedlings. And in the afternoons, there would be a sweet-smelling haze that started about halfway up the valley walls and rose into the highest mountains and then spilled over them, moving north into Canada, riding on the south winds. The fire's haze never settled in our valley, but would hang just above us on the days it was there, turning all the sunlight a beautiful smoky blue and making things, when seen across the valley, a barn in another pasture, a fence line, seem much farther away than they really were. It made things seem softer, too. There was a long, zippered scar on the inside of Glenda's knee that started just above her ankle and went all the way up inside her leg to mid-thigh. She had injured the knee when she was 17, long before the days of arthroscopic surgery, and she'd have to have the knee rebuilt the old-fashioned way, with blades and scissors. But the scar only seemed to make her legs, both of them, look even more beautiful. The part that was not scarred, and even the scar, had a graceful curve to it as it ran such a long distance up her leg. Glenda wore green nylon shorts and a small white shirt when she ran, and a headband. Her running shoes were dirty white, the color of the road dust during the drought. "I'm 32 and have 6 or 7 more good years of running," she said whenever anyone asked her what her plans were and why she ran so much, and why she had come to our valley to run. Mostly, it was the men who sat around with us in front of the saloon, watching the river, watching the spring winds, and just being glad with the rest of us that winter was over. I do not think the women liked Glenda very much, except for Nancy. It was not very well understood in the valley what a great runner Glenda was. I think it gave Glenda pleasure that it wasn't. "I would like for you to follow Glenda on the bicycle," Tom said the first time I met her. Tom had invited me over for dinner. Glenda had gotten into the valley the day before, though we had all known that she was coming for weeks beforehand, and we'd been waiting for her. "There's money available from her sponsor to pay you for it," Tom said, handing me some money, or trying to, finally putting it in my shirt pocket. He had been drinking and seemed as happy as I had seen him in a long time. He called her Glenn instead of Glenda sometimes. And after putting the money in my pocket, he put an arm around Nancy, who looked embarrassed for me, and another arm around Glenda, who did not. And so I had to keep the money, which was not that much anyway. "You just ride along behind her with a pistol." Tom had a pistol holstered on his belt, a big pistol, and he took it off and he handed it to me. "And you make sure nothing happens to her the way it did to that Oakerson woman." The Oakerson woman had been visiting friends and had been walking home, but had never made it. A bear had evidently charged out of the willows along the river road and had dragged her back across the river. It was in the spring when she disappeared, and everyone thought she'd run away. And her husband had gone around all summer making a fool out of himself by talking badly about her. And then hunters found her in the fall, right before the first snow. There were always bear stories in any valley, but we thought ours was the worst, because it was the most recent and because it was a woman. "It'll be good exercise for me," I said to Tom, and then I said to Glenda, "Do you run fast?" It wasn't a bad job. I was able to keep up with her most of the time, and we started early in the mornings. Some days, Glenda would run just a few miles very fast, and other days, it seemed she was going to run forever. There was hardly ever any traffic, not a single car or truck, and I'd daydream as I rode along behind her. We'd leave the meadows out in front of Tom's place and head up the South Fork Road up into the woods toward the summit going past my cabin. The sun would be burning brightly by the time we neared the summit, and we'd be up into the haze from the planting fires, and everything would be foggy and odd-looking, as if we had gone back in time, as if we were living in a time when things had really happened, when things still mattered and not everything had been decided yet. Glenda would be sweating so hard from the running, the summit, that her shirt and shorts would be drenched, her hair damp and sticking to the side of her face, and the sweat would wet her socks and even her tennis shoes. But she was always saying that the people she would be racing against would be training even harder than she was. There were lakes up past the summit, and the air was cooler. On the north slopes, the lakes still had thin crusts of ice over them, crusts that thawed out barely each afternoon, but that froze again each night. And what Glenda liked to do after she'd reached the summit, her face as bright as if sunburned and her wrists limp and loose, sometimes wavering a little in her stride, finally, so great was the heat and her exhaustion, was to leave the road and run down the game trail leading to the lakes, tripping, stumbling, running downhill again, and I'd have to throw the bike down and hurry after her. And pulling off her shirt, she'd run into the shallows of the first lake, her feet breaking through the thin ice, and then she would sit down in the cold water like some animal chased there by hounds. "It feels good," she said the first time she did that. She leaned her head back on the ice behind her, the ice she had not broken through, and she spread her arms out across the ice as if it were resting on a crucifix, and she looked up at the haze in the sky with nothing above us, for we were above the tree line. "Come over here," she said. "Come feel this." I waded out into the pond, following her trail through the ice, and sat down next to her. She took my hand, and she put it on her chest. What I felt in there was like nothing I had ever imagined. It was like lifting up the hood of a car that is still running, with all the cables and belts and fan blades still running, and I wanted to take my hand away. I wanted to get her to a doctor. I wondered if she was going to die and if I would be responsible. I wanted to pull my hand away, but she made me keep it there, and gradually the drumming slowed, became steadier. And still she made me keep my hand there until we could both feel the water's coldness. Then we got out. I had to help her up because her injured knee was stiff. And we laid her clothes out on the rocks to dry in the sun. And we lay out on flat rocks ourselves and let the wind and the sun dry us as well. She said that she had come to the mountains to run because it would strengthen her knee. But there was something that made me believe that that was not the reason and not the truth. Though I cannot tell you what other reason there might have been. We went into the lake every hot day after her run, and there were always the thinnest sheets of ice back in the shadows. It felt wonderful, and lying out in the sun afterward was wonderful too. After we had dried, our hair smelled like the smoke from the fires in the valley below. Sometimes I thought that Glenda might be dying and had come here to live her last days to run in a country of great beauty. After we were dry, we walked back, and as we went back over the crest of the summit and started down toward the valley, we would slowly come out of the haze and would be able to see all the valley below us, green and soft, with the slow wind of the Yak River crawling through the middle of it. And on the north wall of the valley, midway up the slopes, the ragged fires would be burning, with wavering lines and shifting walls of smoke rising from behind the trees, sheets of smoke rising straight into the sky. The temptation to get on the bike and just coast all the way down was always strong, but I knew what my job was. We both did. And it was the time when bears were coming out of hibernation, when everything was. And the safety of the winter was not to be confused with the seriousness of the summer, with the way things were changing. Sometimes, walking back, we would come upon ruffed grouse, males, courting and fanning in the middle of the road, spinning and doing their little dance, their throat sacs inflated, bright and red, pulsing, and the grouse would not want to let us past. They would stamp their feet and spin in mad little circles, trying to block where it was we were going, trying to protect some certain small area they had staked out for themselves. Glenda seemed to stiffen whenever we came upon the fanning males and shrieked when they rushed at her ankles, making as if to peck her. We would stop back at my cabin for lunch on the way back into the valley. I would open all the windows. The sun would have heated all the logs in the house so that when we came inside, there was a rich, dry smell, as it is when you have been away from your house for a long time and first come back. But that smell was always there in my cabin. And we would sit in the breakfast room table and look out the window, out at the old weedy chicken house I'd never used, but which the people who had lived in the cabin before me had built, and we would look at the woods going up on into the mountain behind the chicken house. I'd planted a few wild apple trees in the backyard that spring, and the place that had sold them to me said that these trees would be able to withstand even the coldest winters, though I was not sure I believed it. They were small trees, and it was supposed to be 4 years before they began bearing fruit, and that sounded to me like such a long time that I had had to really think about it before buying them. But I just bought them without really knowing why I was doing it. I also didn't know what would make a person run as much as Glenda did. But I liked riding with her and having coffee with her after the runs, and I knew I would be sad to see her leave the valley. I think that was what kept up the distance between us, a nice distance, just the right-sized distance. The fact that each of us knew that she was only going to be there a certain amount of time, that she would be there for the rest of May and June and all through July and on through most of August, but that then she would be gone. We knew what was going to happen. It was a certainty, and therefore it seemed to take away any danger, any wildness. There was a wonderful sense of control. She drank her coffee black. We would snack on smoked whitefish that I had caught the previous winter. I had a couple of dogs in the backyard, Texas hounds that I'd brought up north with me a few years ago, and I kept them in a pen in the winter so that they wouldn't roam and chase and catch deer. But in the spring and summer, the sun felt so thin and good, and the hounds were so old that I didn't keep them penned up, but instead just let them lie around in the grass, dozing. There was one thing they would chase, though, in the summer. It lived under the chicken house. I don't know what it was. It was dark and ran too fast for me ever to get a good look at it. And it's also possible that even if I had been able to see it, it would have been some animal that I had never seen before, some rare animal, something from Canada, perhaps. Maybe something no one had ever seen. Whatever it was, small and dark with fur, but not shaggy, not a bear cub. It never grew from year to year, but always stayed the same, though it seemed young somehow, as if it might someday grow. Anyway, it lived in a burrow under the chicken house, and it excited the dogs terribly. It would come ripping out of the woods, just a fleet dark blur through the woods, headed for the burrow, and the old dogs would be up and baying right on its tail, but the thing always made it into the burrow just ahead of them. Glenda and I would sit at the window and watch for it, but it kept no timetable, and there was no telling when it would come or even if it would. We called it a hedgehog because that was the closest thing we figured it resembled. Some nights, Glenda would call me on the shortwave radio, would key the mic a few times to make it crackle and wake me up, and then, mysteriously, I would hear her voice in the night, floating in static, as if it were in the night, out with the stars. Her voice, "Have you seen the hedgehog?" she would ask, sleepily. But it would only be a radio that was in the dark house with me, not her real voice. "Did you see the hedgehog?" she wanted to know. And I'd wish you were staying with me. I'd wish you were with me at that moment. But it would be no good. Glenda was leaving in August or September at the latest. "No," I'd say, "no hedgehog today. Maybe it's gone away," I'd say, though I had thought that again and again dozens of times, but then I would always see it again just when I thought I never would. "How are the dogs?" she'd ask. "How are Homer and Ann?" "They're asleep." "Good night," she'd say. "Good night," I would say. On Thursday nights, I would always have Tom and Nancy and Glenda over for dinner. Friday was Glenda's day off from running so that she could drink, could stay up late, and she didn't have to worry about any after effects the next morning. We would start out drinking at the Dirty Shame, sitting out front watching the river, watching the ducks and geese headed north. And then before dusk, we would go back down to my ranch, and Glenda and I would fix dinner while Tom and Nancy sat on the front porch and smoked cigars and watched the elk come out into the dusk in the meadow across the road. "Where's this famous hedgehog?" Tom would bellow, blowing smoke rings into the night, big, perfect O's, and the elk would lift their heads, chewing the summer grass like cattle, the bull's antlers glowing with velvet. "In the backyard," Glenda would say, washing the salad or rinsing off the carrots or the trout fillets, "but you can only see him in the daytime." "Aw, bullshit," Tom would roar, standing up with his bottle of Jack Daniels. And he'd take off down the steps, stumbling, and we'd all put down what we were doing and get flashlights and go with him to make sure he was all right, because Tom was a trapper, and it riled him to think there was an animal he did not know, could not trap, could not even see. Tom had tried to trap the hedgehog before, but had never caught anything, and Tom did not believe there was any such animal. Out by the chicken coop, Tom would get down on his hands and knees, breathing hard, and we'd crowd all around and try to shine the flashlight into the deep, dusty hole to see if there might be a patch of fur, or the tip of a snout, anything. And Tom would be making grunting noises that were, I supposed, designed to make the animal want to come out. But we never saw anything, and it would be cold under all the stars, and we'd be able to see the far-off glows that were the planting fires burning slowly, even into the night, but which were being held in check by backfires. They were in control. We had one of those propane fish fryers, and we'd put it out in front porch and cut the trout into cubes, roll them around in sweet mustard and flour, then drop them in the hot, spattering grease. We'd fix more than 100 of these trout cubes, and there were never any left over. Glenda had a tremendous appetite, eating almost as many as did Tom, and licking her fingers afterward, asking if there were any more. We'd take whatever we were drinking up to the roof, Tom, his Jack Daniels, Glenda and I, rum and cokes, and Nancy, vodka. And we'd sit high on the steep roof of my cabin above the second-story bedroom dormer. Tom sat out on the end of the dormer as if it were a saddle, and Glenda would sit next to me for warmth, as we'd watch the far-off fires of the burns, a flaming orange color as they sawed their way across the mountainside, raging but contained. Below us, in the backyard, those rabbits that had still not turned brown would begin to come out of the woods, dozens of them, moving in on the greenhouse and then stopping, just lining up all around it, wanting to get into the tender young carrots and the Simpson lettuce. I'd put sheets down on the ground out in the backyard to trick them. And we'd laugh as the rabbits moved nervously from sheet to sheet, several of them huddling together on one sheet at a time, thinking they were protected, and all the time moving in on the greenhouse. "Turn back, you bastards!" Tom would shout happily whenever he saw the rabbits start coming out of the woods in the moonlight, and his shouts would wake the ducks down on the pond, and they would begin clucking to themselves, quacking, and it was a reassuring sound. Nancy made Tom tie a rope around his waist and tie the other around the chimney in case he fell. But Tom said that he wasn't afraid of anything and that he was going to live forever. Glenda weighed herself before and after each run. I had to remember that I did not want to grow too close to her as she would be leaving. I only wanted to be her friend. We ran and rode in silence. We never saw any bears, but she was frightened of them, even as the summer went on without us seeing any, and so I always carried the pistol. We had been pale from the long sunless winter, but were beginning to grow brown from lying out by the lake up at the summit. Glenda took long naps after her runs. We both did, Glenda sleeping on my couch, and I'd cover her with a blanket and lie down on the floor next to her, and the sun would pour in through the windows, and there was no world outside our valley. But I could feel my heart pounding. It turned drier than ever in August. The loggers were cutting again. It was always dry and windy, and the fields and meadows turned to crisp hay. Everyone was terrified of sparks, especially the old people, because they'd seen the big fires rush through the valley in the past, moving through like an army. The big fire in 1901, and then the monstrous one in 1921 that burned up every tree except the very luckiest ones, so that for years afterward, the entire valley was barren and scorched, smoldering. And the wind in our faces was hot, and we went down to the saloon in the early afternoons after we'd stopped off at my cabin and we'd drink beer. Glenda would lie on her back on top of the picnic table and look up at the clouds. She'd be going back to Washington in 3 weeks and then down to California, she'd said. We were both brown as nuts. Almost all the men would be off in the woods logging. We would have the whole valley to ourselves. Tom and Nancy had been calling us the lovebirds in July, trying to get something going, I think, but they stopped in August. She was running harder than ever, really improving, so that I was having trouble keeping up with her near the top of the summit on the days that Glenda ran it. There was no ice left anywhere, no snow, not even in the darkest, coolest parts of the forest. But the lakes and ponds and creeks and rivers were still ice cold when we leaped into them, hot and heart hammering. And each time Glenda made me put my hand on her breast, her heart thumping and jumping around as if about to burst out, until I could finally feel it calming and then almost stopping as the lake's cold waters worked on her. "Don't you ever leave this place, Joe Barry," she'd say to me as she watched the clouds. "You've got it real good here, Joe Barry." I'd be stroking her knee with my fingers, running them along the inside scar, and the wind would be moving her hair around. She would close her eyes after a while, and it was hot, but there would be goosebumps on her legs, on her arms. "No, ma'am, I wouldn't do that," I'd say, and take another swig of beer. "Wild horses couldn't take me away from this place. Mm-mm, no, they couldn't." I'd think about her heart jumping and flapping around in her small chest like a fish in a footlocker after those long runs at the top of the summit. I'd wonder how anything could ever be so alive. The afternoon that she set fire to the field across the road from my cabin was a still day, windless, and I guessed that Glenda thought it was safe, that it would just be a grass fire and would do no harm, and she was right, though I did not know that. I saw her standing out in the middle of the field, lighting matches, bending down and cupping her hands until a small blaze appeared at her feet. Then she came running across the field toward my cabin. I loved to watch her run. I did not know why she had set the fire and was very afraid that it might cross the road and burn up my hay barn, even my cabin, but I was not as frightened as I might have been. It was the day before Glenda was going to leave, and mostly I was just delighted to see her. She came running up the steps, pounding on my door, and then came inside, breathless, having run a dead sprint all the way. The fire was spreading fast, even without a wind, because the grass was so dry, and red-winged blackbirds were leaping up out of the grass ahead of it. And I could see marsh rabbits and mice scurrying across the road coming into my yard. An elk bounded across the meadow. There was a lot of smoke. It was late in the afternoon, not quite dusk, but soon would be, and Glenda was pulling me by the hand, taking me back outside and down the steps, back out toward the fire, toward the pond on the far side of the field. It was a large pond, large enough to protect us, I hoped, and we ran hard across the field with a new wind suddenly picking up, a wind made from the flames, and we got to the pond and kicked our shoes off, pulled off our shirts and jeans, and splashed out into the water, and waited for the flames to get to us and then worked their way around us. It was just a grass fire. But the heat was intense as it rushed toward us, blasting our faces with hot winds. It was terrifying. We ducked our heads under the water to cool our drying faces, splashed water on each other's shoulders. Birds were flying past us, and grasshoppers and small mice were diving into the pond with us, where hungry trout were rising and snapping at them, swallowing them like corn. It was growing dark, and there were flames all around us. We could only wait to see if the grass was going to burn itself up as the fire swept past. "Please love," Glenda was saying, and I did not understand at first that she was speaking to me. "Please." We had moved out into the deepest part of the pond, chest deep, and kept having to duck beneath the surface because of the heat. Our lips and faces were blistering. Pieces of ash were floating down on the water like snow. It was not until nightfall that the flames died down, just a few orange ones flickering here and there. But all the rest of the small field was black and smoldering and still too hot for someone with no shoes to walk across. It was cold. I was colder than I had ever been. We held on to each other all night, holding each other tightly because we were shivering. I thought about luck. About chance. I thought about fears, all the different ones, and the things that could make a person run. She left at daylight, would not let me drive her home, but trotted instead, heading up the road to Tom's. That was 2 years ago. The rabbits have changed, then changed again, twice. The hedgehog, I've never seen it again. After all these years, it has left. I wish I knew for sure that was what it had been. I wish I had a name for it. Will it be back? I do not think so. Why was it here in the first place? I do not know. Just the tame, predictable ways of rabbits. That is all I have left now. Is Glenda still running? It is mid-February. It hurts to remember her. The field across the road lies scorched and black, hidden beneath a cover of snow.
Ted Marcoux performed Fires by Rick Bass. I'm Cynthia Nixon. After a brief break, we'll hear a Willa Cather story set at the Metropolitan Opera House in New York City. You're listening to Selected Shorts, recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide, from PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome back to Selected Shorts. I'm Cynthia Nixon. For more information about the stories you're hearing, the readers who are reading them, or the Selected Shorts Writing Contest, you can go to selectedshorts.org or wnyc.org/shorts. And please write and tell us what you think of today's program. In Willa Cather's A Singer's Romance, set in the world of professional opera singers, the drama is all backstage. I'm here in the studio with Shorts literary commentator Hannah Tinti. Hannah, tell us about this story.
Willa Cather was a Pulitzer Prize-winning author and best known for her portrayal of settlers and frontier life in her novels My Antonia and O Pioneers, but she was also a prolific short story writer. A Singer's Romance was published in 1900, but what's uncanny is that it appeared in Cosmopolitan, which concerns itself so much these days with women maintaining their beauty and sexuality. It's this older opera singer. She's not even older. In the story, of course, it's 1900, so she's old because she's 42 or something.
Right.
Actually, Cynthia, A Singer's Romance is kind of a turn-of-the-century Sex and the City episode.
And I guess there is the Cosmopolitan connection as well.
Yes.
The stage and screen actress Marion Seldes is a Selected Shorts favorite. She gives a passionate reading of Willa Cather's love story, A Singer's Romance.
The rain fell in torrents, and the great stream of people which poured out of the Metropolitan Opera House stagnated about the doors and seemed effectually checked by the black line of bobbing umbrellas on the sidewalk. The entrance was fairly blockaded, and the people who were waiting for carriages formed a solid phalanx, which the more unfortunate opera-goers, who had to depend on streetcars, no matter what the conditions of the weather, tried to break through in vain. There was much shouting of numbers and hurrying of drivers, from whose oilcloth-covered hats the water trickled in tiny streams, quite as though the brims had been curved just to accommodate it. The wind made the management of the hundreds of umbrellas difficult, and they rose and fell and swayed about like toy balloons, tugging at their moorings. At the stage entrance, there was less congestion, but the confusion was not proportionately small, and Frau Selma Schumann was in no very amiable mood when she was at last told that her carriage awaited her. As she stepped out of the door, the wind caught the black lace mantilla wound around her head and lifted it high in the air in such a ludicrous fashion that the substantial soprano cut a figure much like a malicious Beardsley poster. In her frantic endeavor to replace her sportive headgear, she dropped the little velvet bag in which she carried her jewel case. A young man, stationed by the door, darted forward and snatched it up from the sidewalk, uncovered his head, and returned the bag to her with a graceful bow. He was a tall man, slender. He looked as dark as a Spaniard in the bright light that fell upon him from the doorway. His curling black hair would have been rather long, even for a tenor. And he wore a dark mustache. His face had that oval contour, slightly effeminate, which belongs to the Latin races. He wore a long black ulster and held in his hand a wide-brimmed black felt hat. In his buttonhole was a single red carnation. Frau Schumann took the bag with a radiant smile, quite forgetting her ill humor. "I thank you, sir," she said graciously. But the young man remained standing, with bared head, never raising his eyes. "Merci, monsieur," she ventured again, rather timidly, but his only recognition was to bow even lower than before, and Madame hastened to her carriage to hide her confusion from her maid, who followed close behind. Once in the carriage, Madame permitted herself to smile and to sigh a little in the darkness and to wonder whether the disagreeable American prima donna, who manufactured gossip about every member of the company, had seen the little episode of the jewel bag. She almost hoped she had. This signorino's reserve puzzled her more than his persistence. This was the third time she had given him an opportunity to speak, to make himself known, and the third time her timid advance had been met by silence and downcast eyes. She was unable to comprehend it. She had been singing in New York now 8 weeks, and since the first week, this dark man clad in black had followed her like a shadow. When she and Annette walked in the park, they always encountered him on one of the benches. When they went shopping, he sauntered after them on the other side of the street. She continually encountered him in the corridors of her hotel. And when she entered the theater, he was always stationed near the stage door. And when she came out again, he was still at his post. One evening, just to assure herself, she had gone to the opera house when she was not in the cast. And, as she had hoped, the dark signor was absent. He had grown so familiar to her that she knew the outline of his head and shoulders a square away, and in the densest crowd her eyes instantly singled him out. She looked for him so constantly that she knew she would miss him if he should not appear. Yet he made no attempt whatever to address her. Once, when he was standing near her in the hotel corridor, she made pointless and incoherent inquiries about directions from the bellboy, in the hope that the young man would volunteer information, which he did not. On another occasion, when she found him smoking a cigarette at the door of the Holland as she went out into a drizzling rain, she had feigned impossible difficulties in raising her umbrella. He did, indeed, raise it for her, and bowing, passed quickly down the street. Madame had begun to feel like a very bold and forward woman, and to blush guiltily under the surveillance of her maid. By every doorstep, at every corner, wherever she turned, whenever she looked out a window, she encountered always the dark signorino, with his picturesque face and Spanish eyes, his broad-brimmed black felt hat set at an angle on his glistening black curls, and the inevitable red carnation in his buttonhole. When they arrived at the hotel, Antoinette went to the office to ask for Madame's mail and returned to Madame's rooms with a letter which bore the familiar postmark of Monte Carlo. This threw Madame into an honest German rage, refreshing to witness, and she threw herself into a chair, and she wept audibly. The letter was from her husband, who spent most of his time and her money at the casino, and who continually sent urgent letters for reinforcement. "It's too much, Toinette, it's too much," she sobbed. "He says he must have money to pay his doctor. Why, I have sent him money enough to pay the doctor bills for the royal family. Here I am singing 3 and 4 nights a week. No, I will not do it." But she ended by sitting down at her desk and writing out a check, with which she enclosed very pointed advice and directed it to the suave old gentleman at Monte Carlo. Then she permitted Toinette to shake out her hair, and she became lost in the contemplation of her own image in the mirror. She had to admit that she had grown a trifle stout, that there were many fine lines about her mouth and eyes, little wrinkles on her forehead that defied the arts of massage. Her blonde hair had lost its luster and was somewhat deadened by the heat of the curling iron. She had to hold her chin very high indeed in order not to have two. And there were little puffy places under her eyes that told of her love for pastry and champagne. Above her own face in the glass, she saw the reflection of her maid's, pretty, slender Toinette, with her satin smooth skin and rosy cheeks and little pink ears, her arched brows and long black lashes, her coil of shining black hair. Toinette's youth and freshness irritated her tonight. She could not help wondering, But then, this man was probably a man of intelligence, quite proof against the charm of mere prettiness. He was probably, she reflected, an artist like herself. A man who revered her art, and art certainly does not come at 16. Secretly, she wondered what Toinette thought of this dark signorino, whom she must have noticed by this time. She had great respect for Toinette's opinion. Toinette was by no means an ordinary lady's maid, and Madame had come to regard her as a companion and a confidante. She was the child of a French opera singer who had been one of Madame's earliest professional friends and who had come to an evil end and had died in a hospital, leaving her young daughter wholly without protection. As the girl had no vocal possibilities, Madame Schumann had generously rescued her from the awful fate of the chorus by taking her into her service. "You have been contented here, Toinette. You like America. You will be sorry to leave," asked Madame as she said goodnight. "Oh, yes, Madame. I should be sorry," returned Toinette. "And so shall I," said Madame softly, smiling to herself. Toinette lingered a moment at the door. "Madame will have nothing to eat, no refreshment of any kind?" "No, nothing tonight, Toinette. Not even the smallest glass of champagne?" "No, no, nothing," said Madame impatiently. Toinette turned out the light and left her in bed, where she lay for a long time indulging in luxurious dreams. And in the morning she awoke, long before it was time for Toinette to bring her coffee, and lay still, with her eyes closed, while the early rumble of the city was audible through the open window. Selma Schumann was a singer without a romance. No one felt the incongruity of this more than she did, yet she had lived to the age of 42 without ever having known an affaire de cœur. After her debut in Grand Opera, she had married her former singing teacher, who at once decided that he had already done quite enough for his wife and the world in the placing and training of that wonderful voice, and he lived in cheerful idleness, gambling her earnings with the utmost complacency. And when her reproaches grew too cutting, he would respectfully remind her that he had enlarged her upper register 4 tones. And in doing so had fulfilled the whole duty of a man. Madame had always been industrious and an indefatigable student. She could sing a large repertoire at the shortest notice, and her good nature made her invaluable to managers. She lacked, certainly, that poignant individuality which alone secures great eminence in the world of art. And no one ever went to the opera solely because her name was on the bill. She was known as a thoroughly competent artist. And, as all singers know, that means a thankless life of underpaid drudgery. Her father had been a professor of etymology at a German university, and she had inherited something of his taste for grubbing and had been immeasurably happy in her work. She practiced incessantly and skimped herself and saved money and dutifully supported her husband, and surely such virtue should bring its own reward. And yet, when she saw other women in the company appear in a new tiara of diamonds, or saw them snatch notes from the hands of messenger boys, or take a carriage full of flowers back to the hotel with them, she had felt ill-used and had wondered what that other side of life was like. In short, from the wastes of this humdrum existence, which seems so gay to the uninitiated, she had wished for a romance. Under all her laborious habits and thrift and economy, there was left enough of the unsatisfied spirit of youth for that. Since the shadow of the dark signorino had fallen across her path, the routine of her life hitherto as fixed as that as one of the planets or of a German housewife had become less rigid and more variable. She had decided that she owed it to her health to walk frequently in the park and to sleep later in the morning. She had spent entire afternoons in dreamful idleness, whereas she should have been struggling with the new roles that she was to sing in London. She had begun to pay the most scrupulous attention to her toilettes, which she had begun to neglect in the merciless routine of her work. She was visited by many massageurs, for she discovered that her figure and skin had been allowed to take care of themselves and had done it ill. She thought, with bitter regret, that a little less economy and a little more care might have prevented a wrinkle. One great sacrifice she made. She stopped drinking champagne. The sole one of the luxuries of life she had permitted herself was that of the table. She had all her countrywoman's love for good living, and she indulged herself freely. She had known for a long time that champagne and sweets were bad for her complexion and that they made her stout, but she told herself that it was little enough pleasure she had at best. But since the appearance of the dark signorino, all this had been changed, and it was by no means an easy sacrifice. Madame waited a long time for her coffee, but Toinette did not appear. Then she rose and went into her reception room, but no one was there. In the little music room next door, she heard a low murmur of voices. She parted the curtains a little and saw Toinette, with both her hands clasped in the hands of the dark signorino. "But, Madame," Toinette was saying, "she is so lonely. I cannot find the heart to tell her that I must leave her." "Ah," murmured the signorino, and his voice was as caressing as Madame had imagined it in her dreams. "She has been like a mother to you, the Madame. She will be glad of your happiness." When Selma Schumann reached her own room again, she threw herself on her bed and wept furiously. Then she dried her eyes and railed at fortune in deep German polysyllables, gesturing like an enraged Valkyrie. Then she ordered breakfast and a quart of champagne.
That was Marion Seldes performing Willa Cather's A Singer's Romance. Next up, a delicious gem by our friend, the delightful Israeli writer and filmmaker, Etgar Carrot. What Do We Have in Our Pockets is performed with great humor and sweetness by the late actor and writer David Rakoff. David was not only a regular voice on public radio programs like This American Life, he was also a close friend of Symphony Space and Selected Shorts, and we miss him dearly.
What do we have in our pockets? A cigarette lighter, a cough drop, a postage stamp, a slightly bent cigarette, a toothpick, a handkerchief, a pen, 2 5-shekel coins. That's only a fraction of what I have in my pockets. So is it any wonder they bulge? Lots of people mention it. They say, "What the f*** do you have in your pockets?" Most of the time I don't answer. I just smile. Sometimes I even give a short, polite laugh as if someone told me a joke. If they were to persist and ask me again, I'd probably show them everything I have. I might even explain why I need all that stuff on me always, but they don't. What the f***? A smile, a short laugh, an awkward silence, and we're on to the next subject. The fact is that everything I have in my pocket is carefully chosen, so I'll always be prepared. Everything is there so I can be an advantage at the moment of truth. Actually, that's not accurate. Everything's there so that I won't be at a disadvantage at the moment of truth. Because what kind of an advantage can a wooden toothpick or a postage stamp really give you? But if, for example, a beautiful girl, you know what? Not even beautiful, just charming, an ordinary looking girl with an entrancing smile that takes your breath away, asks you for a stamp, or doesn't even ask, just stands there on the street next to a red mailbox on a rainy night with a stampless envelope in her hand and wonders if you happen to know where there's an open post office at this hour, and then gives a little cough because she's cold but also desperate. Since deep in her heart, she knows that there's no open post office in the area. Definitely not at that hour. And at that moment of truth, she won't say, "What the f*** do you have in your pockets?" She'll be so grateful for the stamp. Maybe not even grateful. She'll just smile, that entrancing smile of hers, an entrancing smile for a postage stamp. I'd go for that deal any time, even if the price of stamps soars and the price of smiles plummets. After the smile, she'll say, "Thank you," and cough again because of the cold, but also because she's a little embarrassed. And I'll offer her a cough drop. "What else do you have in your pockets?" she'll ask, but gently, without the f*** and without the negativity. And I'll answer without hesitation, "Everything you'll ever need, my love. Everything you will ever need. So now you know that's what I have in my pockets. A chance not to screw up. A slight chance. Not big. Not even probable. I know that. I'm not stupid. A tiny chance, let's say, that when happiness comes along, I can say yes to it and not, 'Sorry, I don't have a cigarette, toothpick, coin for the soda machine.' That's what I have there, full and bulging. A tiny chance of saying yes and not being sorry."
David Rakoff performed Edgar Carrot's "What Do We Have in Our Pockets?" If you've ever thought of writing a short story yourself, here's your chance. Each year, Symphony Space conducts the Stella Kupferberg Memorial Short Story Prize Competition, in which listeners submit new works. For more information, go to selectedshorts.org. I'm Cynthia Nixon. Thank you for joining me for Selected Shorts. Next week, Tales of the High Life by Tom Wolfe and Edith Wharton. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and was directed by Isaiah Sheffer. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Jim Briggs III. Our guest commentator is Hannah Tinty. Our production intern is Malcolm Donaldson. Our programs presented at the Getty Center in Los Angeles are recorded by Phil Richards. Our theme music is David Peterson's "That's the Deal," performed by the Deerdorf Peterson Group. Major support for Selected Shorts has been provided by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, publishers of the Best American Short Stories, edited in 2012 by Tom Parada. Additional support has been provided by the Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the Short Story, the Henry Nias Foundation, the New York Community Trust Program for Performing Arts Groups, Seedlings Foundation, and Warren and Jane Weiss and the Applebaum Foundation. Selected Shorts has also been supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts and with public funds from the New York State Council on the Arts. Selected Shorts is brought to you in part by Zabars.com, delivering New York original toasting bagels, coffee, smoked salmon, babka, and more throughout the 50 states, Puerto Rico, and the Virgin Islands. More information at Zabars.com/shorts. Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and from the PRI Program Fund. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York and is distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.